Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and in particular, welcome to the podcast-only edition of the Weekly, a regular and perfectly natural occurrence in a week when the Culture File debate is being broadcast on a Saturday evening. Check your podcast feed for that, but hang on a minute because we also have right here the latest edition of Rob Long's Martini Shot, Maurice Gohan lost in love with France, and Aoife Gallagher has been discovering what's happened to learning since the P word came to dominate our world. But we begin this time back in the study with writer and environmentalist Paddy Woodworth. Over the lockdowns, Paddy has been helping us compile a shelf of his favourite nature writings, from Rachel Carson to Michael Viney, Mary Oliver to Robert McFarlane. This time he takes down a volume from 2013 by Julian Hoffman, The Small Heart of Things, a book about nature and home and seeing fully the world that's happening about us.
We talk too often about nature and culture as if a hard border ran between them. But they are inseparably intertwined. We go to nature writers in the first place for vivid accounts of wildlife and habitats. But we often find them writing about cultural issues, and also about their personal experience of awe and sometimes troubling mystery in the landscapes they explore. Barry Lopez, for example, is rigorous in his science, yet he confesses that he bows deeply and respectfully as he approaches nesting birds in the vastness of the Arctic. And very few writers interweave people, creatures, plants and landscapes with such insight, and let's not mince words here, with such love for everything and everyone they encounter, as Julian Hoffman does. I returned to reading his first book, The Small Heart of Things, for Culture File, with keen anticipation. I thought it would be a straightforward and very enjoyable task. Well, I was not wrong about its being enjoyable. I have spent very few happier reading hours in my life than I have rereading Hoffman over the last few days. Indeed, I sometimes wondered how I had stayed away from this book for so long. Such was the intense pleasure I found in the images he creates, and in the lucid intellect and passionate emotion with which he illuminates them. But it's not at all straightforward to summarise this book in a few minutes. Many paragraphs demand the kind of close attention you need to bring to poetry. His canvas is very broad. He falls in love, reluctantly, with a beech forest. He is entertained by nomadic Albanian sheep farmers. His account of a butterfly collection in Bucharest and its wildly eccentric creator is worthy of a short story by Vladimir Nabokov or W.G. Sebald, both of whom, incidentally, are stitched seamlessly into the book at various points. Rich as his writing is, it has an enviable lightness that leavens its density. There are stories that sing out to be quoted on almost every page. Here is just one, written after he and his wife Julia walked their beloved Prespa lakeshore in Greece, looking for signs of terrapins. "Tracks are an ancient, magnetic language," he writes, "pulling us in with possibility." The elusive poetry of a print, he continues, reveals details of a life being lived. Soon enough, he finds evidence of a life he had not been expecting. Bridging the terrapin trail in the pale morning sand and dwarfing its delicate path were the prints of a large brown bear. They were fresh, as if the animal had just left. I let out a breath of deep surprise. Secrets and signs surround us, and the land retains a memory of what passes. The book's subtitle, Being at Home in a Beckoning World, is inspired by Rilke, and the writing lives up to the high bar of that reference. For Hoffman, the world, both cultural and natural, is continually gesturing to us if we only keep our senses alert. You might find the reference to home here odd. if I go on to tell you that this is very often a book about migration, starting with the author's own life. Hoffman was born in Yorkshire, but his parents moved to Ontario when he was a boy. He then made a home in London's East End, a hive of human and avian migrants. He now lives in Prespa, a crossroads of cultural and natural diversity, the point where Greece, Albania, and North Macedonia intersect. He encounters migrants everywhere. After a severe storm, velvet scoters, a species of duck he has never seen on Lake Prespa before, turn up one morning. He finally works out that they must have flown 1,500 kilometres west from the frozen Black Sea to find this open water. While researching this theory in Istanbul, he has tea with another migrant, an Afghan teenager whose family has found a safe harbour there. But the young man dreams of returning to his native place. Hoffman is acutely aware of the terrible shadows cast by history, but he resolves them, at least partially, through the resilience of natural landscapes, and by encounters with kind and courteous strangers, even in places riven by conflict. He never underestimates, for humans or animals, the importance of attachment to place, to a landscape, as he puts it, that articulates something of ourselves. But he also constantly reminds us that we can make a home wherever we find ourselves. By fostering in each moment a constant and attentive awareness to what is there in the slanting light, within reach of our fingers, and near enough to taste. To be at home in the world, he concludes, is to let ourselves be drawn into its embrace. Not a bad book, then, to read in the shadow of lockdown.
Paddy Woodworth there with his latest addition to the Naturalist bookshelf. And to run your finger over the other spines up there, check out the Lyric site or wherever you get your podcasts. And next on the Culture File Weekly, the pandemic is teaching, but what are we learning? Most of our casual learning opportunities in the public realm, from pub chats to skill sharing at exercise classes, they're all on hold. At formal learning institutions, however, the show has gone on and learning is being reimagined. The move online has forced teachers of all types to question their methods and sometimes even to question afresh what it means to learn. CultureFile's Áine Gallagher spoke to some of those zooming towards a new understanding of learning.
It is wonderful. If we didn't have online, nothing would be happening at the moment because the pandemic would still be there and we'd all be at home, disconnected from one another. So we do have some connection through the online world, but it is virtual in its name and in its essence. It is not the real deal.
On the screen, you can see their work that they've uploaded, but it's that two-dimensionality. You're not feeling the work, you're not seeing the depths of something or like the layers of paint or like a sculpture or something. You're not really seeing it in its true physical sense.
My name is Dr. Shane Bergen. I'm a physicist and science education lecturer in the School of Education at UCD. Whilst this is an unusual time and a very challenging time for teaching and learning, there is a silver lining in this cloud, and that is that we have all stopped and thought deeply about the nature of teaching and learning, and that's been a wonderful experience. So we've had lots of meetings about the nature of learning, about how is it that we can connect with our students. I think that's a very positive thing, and I hope that when COVID-19 disappears, that we will bring that spirit of renewed focus on learning.
Community and collaboration goes to the very core of what higher education is and what it should be. I suppose one of the biggest challenges for the students is to create that sense of community, to create that sense of peer group. This happens very naturally in traditional teaching. You know, when we all went to college, it was a wonderful time where we had loads of time, I suppose. We weren't timetabled to the hilt. We had lots of chances to go for coffees on campus, to talk to each other, to share our worries, to share what we were learning. And maybe that's what's missing right now. My name is Dr. Anya Mahan. I'm a lecturer in philosophy of education, also in the School of Education at UCD.
So when we go to college, there is this space where we can form identities. We can, as Anya says in her work, we can try certain ones on. You know, we can imagine ourselves different for a few years. Sometimes that can be radically different. You know, we've all remembered people who were committed communists in college and then turn out to be the leaders of a conservative political party. But this is important. I do joke. It is important that when you go to college, that you meet other people and you meet ideas that are different to yours. And this allows you to negotiate your own identity. And so if you're coming to university to be a philosopher, a physicist, an artist, a musician, it doesn't really matter what in terms of the disciplines. What matters is that you're starting to toy with the idea of becoming a physicist. What does that mean? And you learn very quickly that it's a lot more than just sitting in 20 or 30 modules over the space of 4 years. We don't go to school and to college to just become workers, to keep going for the rest of our lives. We go to the school in order to imagine ourselves in a better world. And so Anya and I think an awful lot about the importance of place and space in education.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, the focus that you're placing on physical space. I think all campuses have that atmosphere to them, and they do have those physical spaces where you can sit and loiter and it's not necessarily going against what you should be doing on the street. Let's say you're not supposed to loiter, but a university is built for that. And it's a really important aspect for, yeah, as you say, ideas to grow, and maybe something that's missing in our general streetscape, you know, maybe not something that should be just confined to the campus.
And maybe to think together as well. The philosopher Hannah Arendt talks about the plurality of thinking. It's not something that we do as atoms free floating on our own. It's something that we do as a community, and we can build on each other's thoughts in that way. And she has a lot to say about the civil polity, the exchange of ideas, the marketplace of ideas. And that is essentially what the university can be at its very best.
My name's Anya Byrne, and I'm a textile designer and maker, and I teach in the National College of Art and Design. I also run a series of weaving workshops. Teaching textiles using your hands is the main thing that you're doing, because it's basically a craft. Yeah, the whole purpose of textile design is it begins with the making and the handmade and the manipulation of fabric and materials. Yeah, involves working with your hands and being physically in a space with materials and machinery. The workshops that I'm doing are predominantly frame loom weaving, and more recently they've been moved online, and the most recent one that I did was with the Barbican. Moving that completely online was a real challenge, because there's so much more that you have to think about in terms of planning and preparing videos. The whole workshop before teaching online, it was all through Zoom, was preparing like every single stage of the preparation of setting up a loom, of winding the warp, weaving the threads through the weft. I had to pre-record or film all of those processes.
Through this online teaching, have you learned anything about the materials or about your methods of teaching that you might otherwise have not?
I suppose that methodical way of pre-recording and noticing every stage of the process, and it really breaks things down and makes you think in different ways. In a regular workshop where I have everybody in the room together, I can talk to them all individually and have intimate conversations with people, or sit next to them and show them physically when I'm sitting next to them. And that's such a huge part of workshops and why people go to workshops. It's that community feeling and like gathering together of people, and the conversations that arise through being close to someone and setting up a loom with them. Like, it's obviously a part of them learning the process, but it's also to do with that like connection and the working with your hands, I think. And that's, yeah, such a big part of any craft. And I think there has been a huge movement in the last few years of people wanting to get away from computers and getting away from just staring at a laptop or their computer, where it's this really flat two-dimensional space, but being in a room with people where they're talking to each other and handling thread and yarn, I think it's so important. So it kind of contradicts that whole idea when you are working online.
What I hope is that we learn from this pandemic, in that technology is wonderful, but it isn't the be all and end all. I don't want to sound like a Luddite either. You know, technology enables a lot of the wonderful work we do, but there's something precious about the human experience, about being together in one place at one time. And I hope that we recognize that when this is over.
Dr. Shane Bergen there of UCD ending that report, and you heard also from Anya Byrne of NCAD and Dr. Anya Mahan of UCD. And to complete our full quota of Anyas for this time, the reporter was Anya Gallagher. And next, writer and comedian Maurice Gohan is, like it or not, in a holiday mood and indeed location. But while Emily is indisputably in Paris, Culturefile's plucky ingenue francophile remains in Provence. It's a choice.
I'm still in self-imposed exile in France. I love the French for their Frenchness.
Je t'aime. Je t'aime. Oui, je t'aime.
Say what you want. No one is as French as the French themselves. The man who owns the building I live in is very French. He makes me call him El Presidente. And I don't know if you realize how humiliating it is to be a grown adult and call another grown adult the president. It sounds like a made-up kids thing, like a unicorn or hell. I don't think I could even do it to the actual president. Mr. Higgins, Sir Michael D., nice to meet you, Your Honor. He shows up every evening holding three different phones and wears a white shirt that is so long it looks like he's sporting a dress. And I say, "Bonjour, El Presidente," and he waves back. His wave is more Pope than President, but I don't dare tell him that. I'm not sure what religion the French are. Because of coronavirus, there are no other Irish or English or Americans on the beach, so it's just me and a haze of mahogany bony bodies. The French eat olive oil and mozzarella and fresh baguettes. I guess that's what keeps them so skinny. I've adapted their healthy eating, and I definitely don't look like them. On the beach, little kids stare at me and exclaim something in French, probably, "Mama, beached whale." The French are smokers. Maybe that's how they stay so thin. Everyone and their mother smokes. Shouldn't their mother be dead from all that nicotine?
No.
One of my neighbors I share a courtyard with is 17. And I see her breastfeeding her baby with a cigarette in hand. So bloody French. A girl who lives in the courtyard likes to practice her English with me. One day, when I made sure no one else was looking, I raised my skirt to show her my sunburn. "Ah," she screamed. "Ah, no, no. That's not color of person. That color salmon." I got defensive. "It's fine. It will turn to tan." "Does it not hurt?" she asked, peering at it. "Yes, agony, but you're not listening. We'll turn to tan." "We'll turn to tan" is the Irish mantra of denial. From pale white to hot pink to peeling. "We'll turn to tan," we repeat, lashing layers of aftersun on one day and then shedding like lizards the next. Turning to tan is like the mythical playboy who cheated on his girlfriend for 10 years and then did a 180 and became a devoted husband and father. Sure, we've heard of it. It's been whispered about for years. But has anyone actually experienced it? Everyone in France wears a mask. Everywhere. I think they made it a law. They're not big on social distancing or hand sanitizer. Every time I slap my bum down on a metal chair in a cafe and spend 2 hours sweating off a kilo, I think, coronavirus or not, they should really wipe this down after me. But no, it's all about the mask. I haven't seen a pair of lips in weeks. Funny, the same country to ban hijabs makes masks mandatory. It's almost like it was never about what was covered and more about who was being covered. Anyway, I don't want to get political. That's not very French of me. Or it is, if I got political and just quit halfway. That would be very French of me. Wow, a World War II joke. Give me another month here and I'll be waxing lyrical about Franz Ferdinand and the Treaty of Versailles.
Maurice Gohan there, and never forget you can find all of Maurice's Culturefile pieces where you get your podcasts, because Culturefile is also a podcast. But sure, who am I telling? And bringing it all back home now is the latest martini shot from Rob Long. This time Rob is thinking about the dominant position of lies in a writer's life.
This is Rob Long with Martini Shot. For the next, 10 seconds or so, I'm going to be lying to you. You asked about the script I'm writing? It's going really well. It's almost done. I'm making little changes here and there, but I'll be done with it, I don't know, sooner rather than later, I guess. But what I really want to say is it's going well, and it's basically done, and all of that was a lie. The script isn't basically done. It's not even basically started. I'm not making little changes here and there. I'm aimlessly shopping online and staring out of the window. People in Hollywood, and when I say people in Hollywood, I'm really referring to me. I often take my personal individual character flaws and apply them universally. So when I say things like people in Hollywood are lazy, or people in Hollywood are running out of ideas, or people in Hollywood need to lose some serious weight, what I'm really saying is that people in Hollywood like to project their failings onto people in Hollywood. But this part really is true. People in Hollywood tend to bend the truth. In other words, we lie to each other a lot in this business. Maybe they do in every business. I don't know. I've only worked in this one. It's sort of a cliche to say that we're all liars and double dealers in Hollywood, but it's a business of sharks and no accounts. And mostly when we lie, though, it's not out of malice. We lie to each other to make things simpler. That is a great idea, we tell each other when we share our ideas, and not because it's a great idea, but because the process of really thinking about an idea, entertaining it, and treating it with thoughtful analysis is so exhausting. And worse, what if it's a lousy idea? What do you say then? So it's best just to say, that is a great idea. When can we expect the first draft of the script is another one of those questions begging for a false response. Tuesday, I always say, whether or not Tuesday is the day, or whether or not there's any day on the horizon. Tuesday, I say, with chipper enthusiasm. But today is Tuesday, a studio executive once said to me. Do you mean today? Well, you know, I'm actually thinking that maybe... And then, see, I hung up on myself mid-sentence, which is something nobody ever does. And so it seems like I'm going through a bad reception area or something. Hanging up on yourself isn't exactly... lying, of course, but it does convey a false impression, so I guess it counts. But it gets you out of a troublesome exchange in which the truth... When can we expect the script? Well, I don't know. I haven't started it yet. I'm a bad, lazy, undisciplined person, and I already spent the money. Well, that would be unsatisfying to everyone involved. Look, morally, I get it. These are lies. Falsehoods. Just more small, minor failings that add up over time. But they... keep things moving. They keep the social traffic running smoothly. It's sort of like when you're at a traffic stop and the light is about to turn red and there really, technically, isn't time for 8 cars to go through, let alone your car, the 9th. But you push it and you keep going. And of course, it's wrong. But it's the only way to keep things moving along. It's the same way when you're caught in a tricky situation. You can always hang up on yourself if you really get into trouble and haven't thought of a way to... See? It totally works. And that's it for this week. Next week, we'll be heavily medicated. This has been Rob Long with Martini Shot.
And Rob is at least telling the truth about that. He will be back next week with more news from the frontiers of fantasy. And this month's Culturefile debate gathers a clique of Irish music makers, featuring singer Roisin El Safty, concertina player and dancer Kathleen Nigowan, fiddler with the group Slow Moving Clouds, Alton O'Brien, and the Irish Traditional Music Archive's Alan Woods, for a conversation about where trad finds itself in a world of shuttered snugs and online sessions. That's the Culturefile debate on your radio Saturday Halloween evening at 6:30 p.m. and in your podcast feed whenever you've got a minute. We'll be back on Monday with a new week of Culturefile on RTE Lyric FM. Till then, bye now.